Hello and welcome to the AAMFT podcast, your all-access pass to the latest news, developments, and thought leaders in the world of systemic therapy, where we strive to relate, educate, and innovate one episode at a time. I'm your host, Dr. Eli Karam, and we're brought to you by the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. In addition to featuring unique conversation and interviews with established experts, our show provides information and education on direct practice and emerging trends in the MFT profession. For more information, please visit us at aamft.org. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Step inside, take a seat, let's explore the world of therapy like never before. Dr. Eli's here, bringing voices so bright, innovating, relating, and shedding new light. It's AAMFT, where wisdom meets passion. Come listen and see, talking trends, deep insights, and stories so bold. For MFT minds, the future unfolds. Systemic, my friends, we relate, educate, and innovate again. Stay systemic, my friends. Stay systemic, my friends. Stay systemic, my friends. We relate, educate, and innovate again, one episode at a time. At a time. One episode at a time.
Picture this. You're attempting to have a serious conversation, but the person you're having it with is fully engrossed in their phone or gaming console. Conversation doesn't go anywhere. They don't hear you, and you just get frustrated. Does this sound familiar? Well, many people believe this preoccupation with technology is confined to younger generations, digital natives. But the reality is it's something that affects people of all ages. While technology is now being used for entertainment, work, shopping, socialization, and much more, it's increasingly becoming more important for people to establish boundaries and to know how and when to step away from screens to prioritize other things and relationships. Today on the podcast, we'll take a look at why it can be difficult for our clients and, quite frankly, ourselves as systemic therapists to put down our smart devices and how technology can cause problems for individuals, couples, and families, yet at the same time be beneficial. We're going to do that today with our expert, Catherine Kath Nibbs. She has many titles, but she's a clinical researcher, psychotherapist, consultant, and trainers in the field of cyber trauma and online harms. She runs courses for therapists on topics including data protection, technology, ethics, security, and the theoretical applications of cyber trauma. She is a gaming therapist, which she'll describe today, and share great examples of how she uses technology in therapy to elicit healing and post-trauma growth. Her new book, Managing Your Social Media and Gaming Habits, provides expert guidance on all the burning questions related to our technology use, many of which we tackle today, with particular support for those struggling to regulate their own gaming and social media use. It focuses on the science and simply addressing the information you need to understand as a therapist to help your clients improve productivity and overall mental health. I learned a ton, unlike anyone we've had before on the show. Kath is a wealth of knowledge, and I look forward to hearing what you think. We'll be back after our interview with Kath Nibbs. More healing begins with you. Are you looking for a career with new challenges and opportunities? California Correctional Healthcare Services provides mental health care within the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. We're hiring marriage and family therapists to help individuals heal, grow, and reshape their future. Join a dedicated team, receive state benefits, and make a difference. Your career, your calling, your chance to make an impact. Take the next step. Apply today at cchcs.ca.gov/careers. That's cchcs.ca.gov/careers. Eli, back with you on the AAMFT podcast. I am so happy to be joined by Kath Nibbs, an expert on all things social media, gaming, and how it affects both our clients, but also us as therapists. So we should be able to hit two levels on that today. However, the first question always, Kath, is your origin story. What got you interested in psychotherapy in general, and then specifically working with gaming and social media habits?
Oh, okay. I'll be succinct. So I actually have a background in, let's call it, it's electronic, electrical and mechanical engineering. So I went into the armed forces when I was 18 years of age, was the first woman to do my trade. And really from there, became interested in what Jordan Peterson would call things rather than people. And after a number of years in the army, left and became a wife. And then sadly, as many of the military romances tend to end up, ended up divorcing. And whilst I was raising my children, I really introduced technology into their lives because they were quite little. And this is the beginning of the internet. They get classified as millennials and Gen Z on the cusp. And really, because of the divorce, I'd been to see a psychotherapist myself, and I really had an idea that I could do this type of work myself as well, because it seemed quite logical, quite systemic, and little did I know that's not quite how it works. And when I tried to, let's say, exit the world of technology and move into a space where I was training as a therapist, I couldn't really shake off the influence of things into the world of people. So really, when I became a psychotherapist, it was to work with people. And in that reflection where I've said Jordan Peterson talks about things and people, it tends to be quite a specific male and female trait. And what I've been able to do is synthesize the two spaces together, really.
Yeah, I love that integration of things. And as most people do, you have studied and now work with things you are passionate about, which is technology. Why do we have the technology habits we do? You've done a tremendous amount of research. What do you think the essentials are for therapists to know about their own relationship with technology? Because if we don't understand our own relationship, it's going to be really hard to help individuals, whether they be young or old, with their own habits.
In a nutshell, I would say that's the reason I'm going to call it the little yellow book, because that's the colour of it that's recently been published with the British Psychological Society and Routledge. So it's one of the first of a set of books that they're calling Ask the Experts. And I sometimes struggle with that E word myself. But if we go all the way back to why do we do anything, it's generally a needs-based approach that we're taking. It's developmental, it's neuroscience, it's attachment, it's about belonging. It's about the alloparenting, as it's often called, when we think about what we do as parents. And pretty much the reason we do anything around technology has one of two particular aspects. One is where we need to use it as a tool. For example, we might be coding lots and lots of numbers, and we might use an Excel spreadsheet for that. But in terms of the world of today, I'm trying to do the air quotes thing here, social media is about socializing, and 99% of us pick up our devices, use our phones, use the computer, because actually what we're doing is an extension of ourselves. And so the word I tend to use for this at the moment is an approach that I'm calling the cyber biopsychosocial approach. And really, this is based in a name I gave my podcast in 2018, which is really summarized in the fact that we have synapses between the brain, or synapses as they're often spoken in the US. But there is what Louis Cozzolino calls a social synapse between us in the corporeal world. And in 2018, I started to think, actually, there's also the cyber synapse. And that's the space that we have where an extension of our thoughts and feelings are now in an environment which can be interacted with by an enormous amount of people. So to give figures at the end of 2024, that's really 5 billion people that have the potential to interact with us. And then I'm going to say comma, and added to that now is the space of large language models and artificial intelligence. So the idea of the hive mind and how we can interact is really going to push this level of why we do what we do online, why we do what we do with technology.
Yeah. And what do you think, if you had to distill it down for our listeners, the main connection between what we're going to talk about today, social media and gaming? I feel it's like two sides to a coin. What's the connection between social media and gaming and mental health and well-being?
Oh, now this is a really highly contested area. So I'm going to say, without a doubt, those of us who work in clinics with our clients invariably see what it's like for people to have peer pressure, what it can be like to spend an amount of time in certain domains. And that might actually be the way that we can understand children in a school setting, adults in a workplace, and the kinds of things that happen. So the kinds of experiences that happen in those places and how that has an impact on the person's mental health. But what I will say is the contested argument at this point in time is whether social media as a construct, which is, or gaming, which are both highly difficult terms to operationalize, whether that actually has a direct influence in a causal way. And in the research that's come out over the last really 10 or 15 years, which is very minimal, and I will say that the research around technology, social media and gaming is quite minimal in terms of looking at relationships and mental health. What we do know is that one side of the Atlantic says, yes, it has a direct impact on mental health. And the other side of the Atlantic, i.e. where I'm based in the United Kingdom, there tends to be quite a lot of research that says it's no more dangerous than a potato. In fact, what you will find is there's evidence to show that socializing through social media or having spaces where you can talk to your peers, your friends, and gain support actually provides a positive for mental health. Whether we say that one causes an influence on the other is very difficult. And yet, I return to the point about being a psychotherapist and sitting with a client in a clinic. It is absolutely true for those clients that they might make a statement that says, it's the amount of time I'm playing on the games, it's the amount of time I'm on, and names a platform. And then what we need to do as therapists is really get into the weeds around, and what is it that's occurring in or on those spaces? So it depends on what the technology is as to whether you'll use in or on. And again, in that environment, what's happening? Who's having an effect? What's really going on for the client? What sense are they making of it? And then that helps us really have the language to work with them in the therapy room.
Yeah, it's the context in which our clients interact with the technology, a combination of how they do it and the amount of time they do it. When we think of the potential positives, we'll start first with social media before we talk about gaming. Because I think a lot of times people, especially over here in the States, it is a negative connotation. You don't see articles on the positive effects of social media or gaming. You just see the negatives. This is a profession that we see strength and health and systemic therapy. So let's start with some potential positives of social media.
It might help, Eli, if we give a definition around what social media is.
And please,
that's,
yeah.
That's as, and again, that's difficult because it's as broad as it is wide. But certainly social media, and often people move into the space where they start to name particular types of platforms like Facebook or TikTok or Instagram. The thing about social media is it's a communication channel, or it's a channel in which people can interact in some way, shape or form with other people. Now, if we go all the way back to the 90s, we were doing that with email. And email is a form of social media if you really get down into the nitty-gritty version of what it is. And even sticking with the late 90s and early 2000s, one of the first providers for the internet set up a chat channel that was known as MSN Chat. If we think about what that provided then as to what it morphed into and the behemoth that it's become in 2023, 2024, 2025, post-COVID really, we're talking about spaces in which people can send, usually it's text, audio and video based content, and it also includes static images such as photographs. And in those spaces, it really provides a vehicle with which we can communicate. So one of the first positives is, for many of our clients, it is a way in which they can communicate with people where they might be, for example, bedbound, housebound, they might have a disability, they might have a mental health issue that prevents them leaving their home for whatever reason. And that has allowed us to use versions of social media such as, and I'm not going to get into GDPR with this or data protection, but for example, some services have been provided via WhatsApp, they've been provided via Zoom, and those channels are classified within the domain of social media. And if we think about the positives of social media, it allows for people to be able to stay connected. So mainly I work with children and adolescents. I do work with adults, but many of the stories I'm going to tell really are based in the children that I work with. And some of them are young carers. Some of them are in homes where neglect has taken place emotionally, and yet they have a physical device because within that particular family, that's the way in which love is really shown. And yet the child is sitting there with the deprivation of human-to-human contact. And what these social media channels allow for a lot of these young people that I'm working with is for them to be able to connect with people and form friendships. It's allowed some of my LGBTQIA plus clients to be able to find support. They've been spaces where a lot of the clients who self-harm and have suicide ideation and eating disorders and disordered eating and other mental health issues, they've been able to find their, as they often call it, a squad, but we're talking about a tribe. We're finding the people who we belong with, and we can do that through the spaces of technology. And to give a few more positives, I've worked with children who weren't quite sure what they were going to do in terms of their options in secondary school about what they might do as a career. And through conversations in therapy and a shared experience of YouTube videos, what it allowed them to do was develop a passion for baking, for astronomy, for physics, for unique interests. And certainly one of the most positives that I find of the social media space are for many of my clients who have the diagnoses of autism or ADHD or OCD, and it allows them to really find out information, connect with other like-minded people, connect with other people who are like them. And that is really what really, really matches soul to soul in terms of human to human connection. So that the positives are often omitted, and yet it's something that we all engage in every day in terms of why we're doing what we're doing online.
What do you think the positives are with gaming, which obviously has a huge, I'm 47 years old, when I had a Nintendo when I was 10 or 11, the idea of it being interactive was playing with my brother with the second controller. Now, it's hard to imagine a successful game franchise or series without a connective online component.
So if I give you the monetary figure, by 2030, it's expected somewhere in the region of £230 billion is going to be poured into the gaming community and what gaming actually is. So if we think about where we're heading, it's an enormous amount of leisure time. It's going to be an enormous amount of our belonging and collective play. So in terms of the benefits, so I actually use gaming in therapy with children. In fact, actually, one of my little clients today had told a story to his auntie, because normally it's mum who drops him off, and he'd told this auntie. So I'm going to go and see Kath, but I don't really talk about my feelings. I just play on the VR or I just play on the Xbox. And of course, the auntie laughed when she was dropping off this little boy. And I said, that's what it looks like on the surface to a lot of people. It looks like I'm pretty much using all of this technology in my office. And to a person who's naive or maybe ignorant of what gaming is, oh my goodness, you can have autonomy. In fact, I'm just going to dial back a couple of steps. You can begin with the idea of creating a character. In a lot of games nowadays, particularly the online versions, the split is currently 50-50 across sexes in terms of who now plays games, whereas I think with you suggesting around the age of the Nintendo many years ago, that where you would have been playing, Eli, it was mainly a male-dominated space. But now it's occupied by both males and females. And in that environment...
Hey, the new Star Wars game has a female heroine, the main component. So certainly, yeah, and I see just as many teenage female gamers almost now as I do males in practice.
And it's incredible, actually. The better players on Fortnite that come into my clinic are the females, but I generally don't tell many of the males that. But if I go back to the idea of when platform games first came out, so these were called either computer games or video games. Again, this digital, electronic, cyber, this gaming space, there is so much nomenclature that it's difficult to actually say video game or computer game and not get confused with the age at which those terms were used. But in the early days of 2D platform games, the ones that you might find at the arcade, and certainly the type that you might have played, Eli, in terms of Sonic or something like that, going all the way back, you would have been given a character, or you could choose from a set of maybe six. So you might choose, if you were playing one of the martial arts games, you might choose a tall person, a shorter person, a skilled person, a person in a karate suit, a person in a fancy dress suit. And that would be the limit to who you could be in that game. And I'm doing air quotes or brackets around the word be. Because what we can do now is we can project into an avatar. So this is what they're often called, an avatar or a game playing character, parts of our psyche, parts of ourselves. And we can change the way that their skin looks. We can change the way their hair is, whether they have accessories, often called skins in games, whether we provide them with certain characteristics. And that can take place in games that are about shooting or games that are about adventure or games that are about puzzle solving. And you can really become somebody else and you can be partly a fantasy character. And I want to spell that with a PH. I want to say that there's a difference between a fantasy character in a game and what we might do if we were, I don't know, in clinic using a particular modality of depth psychotherapy and Santray work. So what people can now do is not only can they pretend to be somebody else, they can actually become somebody else. And in doing that, it allows us to actually traverse into a space where the questions we can explore with a client becomes so much richer, so deep, and we can learn so much about a client's wants and needs and lacks that we can go through the whole spectrum of kind of a therapeutic alliance in less than one session, because that client can really show you their ideal self, real self, who they become when they're dealing with a particular problem. We can help them gamify a particular situation by using elements from the game. So for those that are not familiar with gaming language, in gaming situations, when you achieve and you're due to go on to a next level, you generally have to fight the hardest fight of that level. And it's often called fighting a boss. And sometimes I might talk to my young clients and say, okay, who is a boss in your real world? Who's a boss that you would really like to beat in your class or at your rugby club or when you go swimming? And quite often you can then design those characters within the game, or you can talk about taking elements from the game. And many computer games follow pretty much a hero's journey when you actually strip the game apart in terms of what it is that you're doing. And then the positives that, and I'm aware that was a long-winded way of getting to this, Eli, the positives of gaming are you can, I don't know, even if it's a simple puzzle game, you can begin to use logic, you can begin to cognitize, you can begin to move your thinking forward in terms of solutions to a problem. You can generalize from using these games into seeing your problem in a different way. You can gain mastery, autonomy, agency, success. You can think about what it is that you're actually doing in a game and how that relates to the way in which you perceive your world. So to give you a very quick story around this, there's lots of different ways to play the game Fortnite, and it's a very popular game for young people at the moment. But what I find is that there's a number of approaches to how children perceive problems that they're facing, and many of the children will land in the middle of the map and they will go gung-ho to have a shoot 'em up match, because actually that's the point of Fortnite at the very end of the game. Other children might try and hide. Other children might try and go and collect as many weapons and gold and create as much building material as they can in order to think about, I might need this in the future. So what often happens is you can perceive how a child thinks about their problem just from watching gameplay. And also, the other thing that comes out of the positives of this, Eli, is the amount of information young people can process, pay attention to, and interact with in a way that I don't think we've really understood at this point in time in terms of neuroscience. And I will say my reflection on that is when I also played with the Sega and the Nintendo, there wasn't a lot of information to remember. You had maybe 8 buttons on a controller. And I can be sitting in a session with a 5-year-old who is using an Xbox controller, playing a game that has a map on, that has information that's popping up every 10 seconds with notifications. There's audio messages that keep popping up. There's a direction arrow that they need to follow. And in those games, they are then also playing with other players that they might call a squad. And I don't think we've realised just how quickly young children have been brought into this environment and how much, like ducks to water, they have taken to it.
Oh, so much good stuff there. I could not agree with you more. If you want to join with a teenager, engaging them through a game that is a world in within a world in that language, whereas you would ask them questions outside of that, they may give you one or two word answers, but you engage them through the game. And so much, as you said, is what we call in family systems isomorphic, a parallel process to how they approach the game, to how they approach other parts of their life. And you become a credible source with them if you know about the game. But even if you don't know about the game, it, like you said, if you know the hero's journey, if you are open and you are willing to talk to that, because many times from, and we'll talk about this as we go on today, that the child or teen is secure in their relationship with the technology, but the parent is not. So you are modeling many times, as we do in family therapy, how to show curiosity instead of judgment. And what you just said in that opening moment, it creates so much space to learn about the child in a way parents probably, especially parents that are non-gamers, completely miss that opportunity. So let me give you some scenarios and you tell me both assessment and then intervening. A parent and their child comes in, this is a typical presentation to many of our listeners, even if we're going to do the work with one part of the system, i.e. the teenager, we're going to have contact with the parent, and we may have child and parent sessions or parent sessions. First, how do we assess what is an appropriate use of social media and gaming? I know those, they are a little slightly different flavors, but, and then how, if the parent is saying, hey, I want you to go out and have real friends, where they are delegitimizing the social connections and the outlets that come online, because that is not what the parent is used to. And the parent has invalidated a part of that young person's reality or socialization or friendship network. How would you deal with a situation like that?
Often I'm looking for words like addicted and won't get off the phone. If I was dealing with, let's go with Timmy, okay, made up client, obviously. Timmy's mom comes in and says, he won't go to school and he won't get off that damn phone. And when I send him to bed, he's got the console on, he's constantly on his devices, he won't speak to me, and so on and so forth. So often I'm looking at what's the presenting problem? And it's usually miscommunication and missed connection between parent and child. Now, that probably doesn't come as a surprise to anybody listening to this at this point. But certainly I would be saying, okay, so when you say device, what do you mean? What kind of technology have you got in the home? How old is Timmy? If he's 14, that might mean that he's old enough to go on most of the social media channels. And he would be allowed on particular games, but maybe not the ones that have the ERS ratings of mature. So one of the things I might ask is, okay, so what games does he use? What games do you know that he's playing on the console, whether that's the Xbox, PS or computer? And then I might talk about, okay, and when he's playing those games, does he have a headset on? Is he getting quite animated when he's playing the games? And what do you really hear from his bedroom, or from, if you've got it down in the shared area downstairs, what do you really hear from him and the way that he approaches the game? And then I might talk about social media and say, okay, so what platforms is he on? How long does he go on them? And what do you really know about his technology use? And then it comes to the questions about, and how much sleep does he get? And what rules do you have in the house? For example, about lights out, what conversations do you have about appropriate times to use the device? What do you do, for example, about maybe sitting together on dinner time? What do you do in terms of your usage? What platforms do you go on? How much time do you spend with your child? And how much time are you on your device and not spending time with your child? And then I talk about maybe the family's technology use. Are there any siblings? How often does this technology get in the way? When you say it gets in the way, what are we really talking about? And then really from there, I would then be making the decisions about conversations, specifically about certain platforms. But what I would then do, and it's going back to the gaming thing, Eli, is quite often parents don't understand the gaming platform. So the question I have for all of them is, and do you play with your child? Do you actually play one of these games? Oh no, I can't play Cast because I'm not very good at it. And I say, and do you watch your child play a game? And more often than not, that's the question that gives me an insight into how much a parent is involved in a child's technology use or not, would be the first part of the question. And what was really the next part?
We could play off it in a couple of ways. So let's say in some ways, the young person, even though they game a lot, they are doing well in these other categories. They're doing well in school. They are not a problem in any other way, but the parent just feels you need more in-person friends. We get this a lot. And the young person is, I have a community of people in my squad, in there. And some of these people I see in real life, and some of these people are just virtual, but they're real people. And I talk to them much like you talk to your friends in high school, mom, dad. So we see that a lot, the, as I call it, the sometimes unintentional invalidation of a young person's social network through the gaming. How would you deal with that?
A lot of the time I get, many parents will say things, I just don't get it. They're not proper friends, or he should be out playing more and exercising more, and, or she doesn't have enough extracurricular activities. She's always playing with her friends on the device. Now, more often than not, I am usually in the first session having these conversations with the parent just to get a sense of how the parent talks about the technology. And then I'll say, okay, bring Timmy along and tell him that I've got an Xbox in the room. Tell him I've got the VR set. Tell him I've got all these computer games and he can come in. And then what I generally do is obviously, as most people do, it's come in the room. This is who I am. This is what I do. And I go, and do you use this? Usually pointing towards like the Xbox or something. And I'll get a nod and I'll say, yeah, mum says you play on it quite a lot. And I say, Xbox or PS? And then we'll have a conversation in front of the parent, Xbox or PS, PS. And I say, why the PS? Because you can do this and you've got a chat on it and you've got this and you don't have to buy a game pass and you do that. And I say, okay, what kind of games do you like? And then it depends on, again, obviously, how well a young person's engaging. But I can start to throw the acronyms out at them. And I'm like, do you like MMORPGs or FPSs, action games? Do you like your platform ones? And generally what I get then is a conversation with the young person in front of the parent. And I say, okay, so let's say you're playing on Fortnite. So I say, Battle Royale? Yeah, Battle Royale. Okay. And how far do you usually get through each game? I've got an X number of crowns or... And what starts to happen is the young person starts to talk about what they're doing on these games. Now, if anybody does not know how Fortnite works and the words and the acronyms I've just used, I think, Eli, we could put them into maybe some show notes or detangling and understanding the MMORPG type language. So what I mean by that...
I will say I think that is a good point is for our therapists out there. Even if you are not a gamer, you don't have children that are gamers, the type of game, like a role-playing game, a first-person shooter. And then Fortnite, what I love about that, which I think while you're using that example, is it had an extended run now as we are in 2025. And my children started playing that. They're 15 and 16 now. They started playing that when they were six because everybody else was. And I wouldn't classify my kids as hardcore gamers, but they, because everybody in pop culture plays it. So you almost feel like you're missing out if you don't. So yeah. Fortnite has a reach from very young children to, I know many adults that
yes.
If you're going to learn one, that'd probably be a good one to learn. Yeah.
Yeah. So if I told you that there are computer games that my children who are mid to late 20s now, so I've raised these children often referred to as digital natives. So some of the games that came out when they were before the age of 10 and on the computers that were online gaming spaces, such as World of Warcraft. Second Life doesn't do so well anymore. That was a game I studied when I was in university in 2005, 2006, no, maybe even before then. But some of these games like RuneScape, Minecraft, let me see, Call of Duty, but that's for 18 plus in the United Kingdom and mature audiences with the RSB rating. There's a lot of computer games that are free to download onto a console. So what I generally suggest to people is if you haven't got a console, you can go to many different places, whether they're libraries or there's lots of places, but the best one to go to is to go to a gaming shop in the mall and go and find somewhere that's got one of the consoles set up, whether it's a toy shop or somewhere like that, and have a look at the games and maybe even have a go on the games. But certainly the best place in the world ever to learn about these games is YouTube. And there are loads and loads of grown-ups and loads of children who play these games. But not only do they play them, they record them while they're playing them. So they are giving you a how-to manual that you can go and watch in your own time to see why these games are so successful. Now, I would certainly say the speed at which these streamers, as they're called, playing the games, might leave you bamboozled. So what I often do, if I go back to that story, Eli, is I will give the kid the controller and I'll say, so what do you want to go on then? Fortnite? Yeah. And I go, Mum, have you ever watched him play Fortnite? She goes, no. I say, okay. So Timmy, you start playing the game. I'll tell you, Mum, how the game works. And then when you've had a go on that, what we're going to do is we're going to give her the control and we're going to get her to play Fall Guys. Now, if I give you an example, on my social media channel, that is one of the biggest viral videos that I did where I talked about using gaming in therapy and getting parents to play Fall Guys. Because what's so interesting in that moment is the amount of emotional regulation that a parent doesn't have because they can't play the game or they end up giggling. Excuse me, they end up giggling or they get frustrated or they say they can't do it. And we actually have a conversation about the level of animation that's required for these computer games. But all the while, when Timmy is playing Fortnite, I'm generally having a conversation with Mum saying, okay, so as you can see, there's 100 players that begin the game. And in this scenario, in my office, there are no microphones turned on. Everybody is muted. And no, we cannot accept friends. But can you imagine Timmy playing this game with his friends and there's four of them and they've decided they're going to go on this game and they're going to try and win a prize? What do you think's going to happen between the four young people? There's going to be collaboration. There's going to be communication. There's going to be planning. There's going to be forward thinking. There's going to be the executive function part of the brain will come into its own. And being able to sit with the parent and say, would you say that these are friends then, the people that he's playing with when he's collaborating and they've got a plan that's going together, and if it doesn't work, they can all talk about it afterwards. And mum goes, yeah. And I say, and what sport does that remind you of? And quite often, words like soccer, rugby, American football, badminton, puck, it doesn't matter. Any sport has this same camaraderie, this same idea of here's the plan, here's how we're going to do it. And it's what a coach helps them do. So one of the things that you can really do is start to help the parent understand how what on a screen is a reflection of what you would do in the real world as well.
I don't know if they have this in the UK, but many schools in the US now in high school, they have gaming teams where the same thing with a coach and working together and in collaboration. So it has been legitimized in many ways. So in this scenario, you have the console in the room. You are engaging the parent while the young person is playing the game, and using that as a teaching moment right there. I think that's great. Tell us some other ways where in the session you use the games in a therapeutic way.
The esports stuff I tend to talk about in terms of, we'll just bring up a YouTube video and I show parents, look, this is the space in which you can go into. And quite often I tell them the story about the young person whose mum thought he was addicted. And then when he won $1 million, she actually changed her mind.
Yeah.
So we have...
She was okay with it then.
Yeah, it was totally okay then. So some of the games I actually have belong to an organisation which is in the US, and there's a franchise in the United Kingdom. And this organisation is called HeartMath, and they've produced biofeedback software, which is in the form of game. And this biofeedback software is really helpful for understanding the way that your nervous system responds. And quite often, I will, especially with children who might be presenting with anxiety, children who present with emotional-based school avoidance and other issues. And I use this a lot with the adults as well, to be perfectly honest, Eli. And this is where I'm going to say to the listeners, so this doesn't have to apply just to children, but the biofeedback software is a non-invasive way for people to see how their coherence or heart rate variability is in the moment to moment. Let's just pretend that I'm working with somebody who's in their 20s, so that's still young adult, and they say, I don't get stressed at games, or I don't get stressed at work, and I've got whatever problem it is. And I'll say to them, okay, maybe science is a good way to measure what we're doing at the moment. So how do you fancy going on this particular game? And one of the games is very simple. You're watching a ball going on a sine wave. Another game is looking at a picture, and the more coherent you become, the quicker the picture fills in with colour. And then there are games where you actively have to press keys on a keyboard. And those games can be, so one of the games that I've got is a jet ski. And when you become less coherent, the waves become higher, it becomes foggy, and it becomes really difficult to play the game. And the game will prompt the player, breathe in through your belly, think about positive thoughts, think about a way to become more coherent. And I can actually sit and work with clients in a way where this little clip goes on their ear or on their finger, and I talk to them about heart rate variability, and we actually gamify the human nervous system in order for them to learn how to self-regulate and become a coherent individual, which is very different to somebody who's way out of their window of tolerance in terms of managing their emotions, managing their gut system, managing the way that they're breathing. And it's a really simplistic but deep way to work with a client, even in a simple staring at the screen, breathing in time with a ball going up and down a sine wave.
No, I love hearing about all this. We could do another hour in this, and I'm conscious of my time. I think that we also get a lot of requests, if we go back to the social media for a second, mm-hmm. for young people that they can't put it down. They feel like they're missing out. They post everything. They define their self-worth based on how many likes they get. Let's talk about a scenario where we're working with someone that is very attached to their social media. Mm-hmm. What are the things we should look for, and how do you work with someone like that?
Generally, this tends to be young people between, I would certainly say, the ages of 12 and 17. After about 17, that cohort of people have tended to understand what it is that they're, in air quotes, doing and why they're doing it. Whereas the cohort of this kind of 12 to 17 year old seems to be in there. And this is all about adolescence, and I don't want to go too techie on the, this is about attachment, this is about neuroscience, this is about being a teenager. This is about what is required of you as you move from child to adult, and how you perceive what might be your friendship circles. Or for a lot of the children that I'm working with and the young people, it's the where I feel I don't belong, and therefore the amount of effort and time I have to put into these spaces. So I'm going to say there is a massive distinction between the teenagers now and the ones of 10 years ago. And that's because the numbers of channels or the numbers of platforms in which they have to be has exponentially increased. So if we go back to 10 years ago, it was Facebook, Messenger type apps, but there weren't as many as there are now. So what generally happens for young people is they will get asked a question on Snap, which is Snapchat. They will get asked a question on Snap. They will then go into a WhatsApp group where there's a particular set of friendship peers. They will talk about what they've been asked on Snapchat, and they'll have a discussion about it, to then go back to Snap to answer the question, to then send something else on maybe Instant Messenger, to then go and check something out on Instagram, to then come back to one of the other channels. And this is why it often looks like there's so much time devoted to being in those spaces. Because if we go back to pre-internet and we think about what teenagers did, they were collected together in one space, geographically and physically. So they might be out on the street, up near a bus stop, I don't know, near a playground or a skate park, somewhere like that. You could only interact with the people you were interacting with in that physical location. Whereas now there is, and it's, you're going to have to use your imagination here, as are the listeners, that actually you are physically at the skate park, as well as being at the bus stop, as well as being at the sports club, as well as being at the zones. And some friends are also in those locations at the same time, and some are not. And what young people find themselves doing is keeping up with the conversations they're having here and now, but also they will, when they put their phone down, still continue thinking about those conversations, because sometimes the time zones of the people that they're conversing with mean that they have to put their device down and pick it up later in terms of a conversation.
I wonder if you could leave us with a couple of tips for our listeners of how they would help a young person, or an adult for that matter, that is invested in the outcome of that. They cannot put the phone down.
So the main fear is often purported in mainstream media as FOMO, which is the fear of missing out. I'm actually going to suggest it's more around fear of being kicked out and what Michael Gervais calls FOPO, which is fear of people's opinions. And the reason I say the fear of being kicked out is if for young, and certainly this is true of many of these group chats and spaces in which lots of people collect, if you are not engaging in that space, there is the temptation from the group owner, the person who created the race course, so to speak, to take off whatever horses they so wish. And they can do that publicly. So not only do you get removed or rejected from a, for example, group chat, but it also notifies everybody that you've been removed from the group chat. And more often than not, when somebody is removed from a group chat, somebody else will then go and set up another group chat. So what I would be saying to pretty much all of us today, and this is really where I'm writing about this in books at the moment and what I do in lots of the training, is we need to build young people's self-esteem so that they do not need to rely on these large numbers of other people's opinions. And that doesn't begin with technology. That begins in early childhood. That begins with attachment and contingent moments and praise, and certainly what Dan Siegel would call the being seen, soothed, safe and secure approach. And that really, Eli, is why I went to do the TEDx talk, in terms of there are so many of us nowadays who do not feel that we get our needs met in a face-to-face conversation, that we are looking for that same kind of level of connection through devices.
That makes complete sense to me. And I think so much of what you said is going to resonate as we move forward. And many therapists that I train, especially digital natives, as you said, they understand inherently a lot of these things. This is clearly in our scope of competence, as we say, as systemic therapists. But and to be more up to date, I think following anything of what you said today will really help, including the great resource, your book, which is set up in a question answer format. I want you to quickly mention that. And then your website, which has a plethora of information, including trainings on there. So please, in the last couple of minutes, plug whatever you want and how therapists want to know more about what we've talked about today, especially the gaming stuff is so fascinating to me, how you presented it, how they can get more information on how to integrate that into their practice of psychotherapy.
So what I will also do is plug some other people's books. So in terms of just that reflection that I made about what we need to do for everybody, never mind about just children, is to think about reading Sherry Turkle's Reclaiming Conversation book. It is and it's written by or from a psychodynamic perspective about the way that communication has changed since technology began. Now, this is way before the numbers of platforms are around at the moment. But if you want to understand games and gaming, then you need to be reading the books by Tony Bean, Rachel Cowart. These are people who are quite well known in the US in terms of people I've spoken to in the past. There are organizations that will help you understand what we call tabletop role-playing game, but taken into a digital space. And you will find a lot of that through the Geek Therapy and the Geek Therapeutics communities. So there's just a little bit of resources, certainly in the US for training. And then, the book. I'm constantly writing, Eli. So at the moment, I'm currently writing my seventh book, which is due to be handed in a couple of weeks. So I would say that the first book that I wrote with Routledge was called Children, Technology and Healthy Development. And it isn't just about children for a start off. It just happens to be that it's got children on the front page. But certainly that talks about the neurobiology, the attachment and the process of something I call e-tachment, so that we can really understand what's happening with clients. And the most up-to-date book is the one that's called How to Manage Your Social Media and Gaming Habits, because I do not professionally believe in the word addiction in this space, because actually we're socializing in most of these cases.
The website, which is great, is Children and Tech. Spell that out, childrenandte. ch.co.uk. You are a wealth of knowledge, and I think I would like to have you back in the future to talk about another really important topic affecting our work related to what we're saying today, which is cyber trauma. And I know you are an expert in that too. And I think that we could certainly do a whole nother show on that. But I thank you so much, Kath Nibbs. Eli, back with you, bringing to a close another informative installment of the AAMFT podcast. Did you know that AAMFT is active on all your favorite social media channels? Be sure to follow us, the AAMFT, on Instagram, X, Facebook, and LinkedIn. And you want to stay up to date with everything going on in the world of AAMFT, you can always find the back installments of the podcast anywhere you find your favorite podcast. I am partial to Apple Podcast and Spotify, but it's on Google Play, Stitcher. So please, if you're new to us, check out back installments where we tackle the latest trends and events impacting the world of systemic therapy like today. And I have a number of pioneer interviews, which is some of my favorite interviews to conduct over the years. You can drop me a line at elikaram.com, where you see everything going on in my world, including two books that are out. One for our young professionals, Marriage and Family Therapy, National Exam, Your Guide for Success. That's from Springer. And that will prepare you for the national exam, including 360 practice questions, a full-length mock exam, proven strategies and tips for test taking, and it's organized to match the domains of the licensure exam. And then, if you're interested in these common factors that we always talk about on the show, including what makes a motivated client, how you build, nurture, and repair a therapeutic alliance, how you maximize your own therapist factors, you want to check out my book, Bringing Common Factors to Life in Couple and Family Therapy from Rutledge. As always, thank you so much for listening. And until next time, my friends, stay safe, stay systemic.
Illuminate from theory to practice. There's so much to know. Join us on this.